From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The flame, the Olympic flame, used to be burned off of gas or coal. Now the Olympic flame is burned off of dollar bills, $1,000 bills, $1 million bills, and so forth like that.
1968 Olympic medalist John Carlos. He raised his fist in the Black Power salute during the national anthem as a protest against U.S. racism. Today, Olympic protests, past and present, and we'll talk about Olympic dreams, the impact of mega events on local politics. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. In a hard-hitting counterblast to war crimes charges at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal, former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic accused the U.S. and other Western governments of plotting the destruction of Yugoslavia as part of a drive for global domination. He accused NATO of what he called bestial genocide in Yugoslavia and demanded that former President Bill Clinton and other Western leaders come to testify. In a confident, free-flowing speech lasting almost 4 hours, he ridiculed the court as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy designed to humiliate, isolate, and silence him for defending Serbia against Western aggression in the Balkans. The court's three scarlet and black robe judges sat in stony silence. The prosecutors, who accused Milosevic of genocide and crimes against humanity in the Balkans wars of the past decade, looked on impassively. Milosevic used the high-tech courtroom's video monitors to show a German documentary critical of NATO's airstrikes against him. He also directed a court official to show harrowing photographs of severed heads, charred bodies, and blasted buildings from NATO's bombing of Yugoslavia. Milosevic could face life in prison if convicted at the end of an epic trial expected to last at least 2 years. This news from Pakistan. The chief suspect in the abduction of American journalist Daniel Pearl said in court today he was involved in kidnapping the Wall Street Journal correspondent and said he believes Pearl is dead. Sheikh Omar Saeed, an Islamic militant leader, told a judge in the southern port city of Karachi that the abduction was part of a plot designed to show that Pakistan should not kowtow to U.S. imperialism. He contradicted earlier comments attributed to him that Pearl was still alive. Though a body has not been found and Pakistan's government cast doubt on the assertion, several key police investigators said privately they believe Saeed. During interrogation this week, Saeed told investigators that Pearl was shot and killed when he tried to escape around January 31st. Newspapers in Pakistan are reporting that U.S. aircraft over southern Afghanistan have scattered $100 bills tucked into envelopes bearing a picture of President George Bush. Some of the envelopes were carried by the wind and fluttered to earth over the Pakistan border town of Chaman, sending people scrambling for the cash. Witnesses said the envelopes bore no message. The U.S. aircraft first dropped the envelopes on Wednesday afternoon and made a second run to drop their paper payloads yesterday morning. In recent weeks, U.S. aircraft have dropped leaflets over the same area depicting Mullah Omar as a dog held on a leash by Osama bin Laden. Back in the United States, moving swiftly to capitalize on the House approval of the first major overhaul of campaign finance laws in nearly 30 years, the bill's supporters yesterday claimed mounting momentum in the Senate and vowed to push for final passage as soon as possible. The House's post-midnight vote brought the legislation closer than ever to the brink of enactment, prompting a Capitol Hill victory rally by its supporters. GOP and Democratic operatives, meanwhile, scrambled to devise alternatives to the many millions of dollars they now raise in so-called soft money donations, which would be outlawed under the bill. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, lawmakers are telling the Pentagon that they want to increase spending on conventional big-ticket weapons programs, particularly warships and planes. Though the Bush administration has proposed a $379 billion Pentagon budget for next year, that includes a $48 billion increase, the largest rise in military spending in 20 years, many senior lawmakers from both parties contend the plan does not include enough money for new equipment. An Enron executive who warned of dire financial problems months before Enron collapsed appeared before a congressional committee yesterday and placed much of the blame for the company's demise on its former chief executive, Jeffrey Skilling. The executive, Sharon Watkins, also pointed a finger at Andrew Fastow, the former chief financial officer who headed some of the company's fraudulent partnership deals. She said he tried to dismiss her after she rang alarm bells about the partnerships. In more than 4 hours of testimony, the whistleblower described a culture of intimidation at Enron, where there was widespread knowledge of the company's shaky finances, but no one felt confident enough to confront Skilling or Fastow. Sharon Watkins' testimony was vigorously disputed by Skilling's lawyer, who suggested she was an uninformed opportunist. And President Bush unveiled an alternative to the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty he spurned last year, to the dismay of environmentalists who saw the plan as a gift to corporate America. The Sierra Club charged the Bush administration is sticking to the polluting policies that the energy industry has asked for. A statement from Greenpeace said the White House directive is written, paid for, and delivered by Exxon. In one of his first actions upon taking office in January 2001, Bush yanked U.S. support for the 97 Kyoto Protocol, which requires wealthy nations to cut to 1990 levels of the emissions of greenhouse gases blamed for global warming. Bush sparked a worldwide uproar with his decision to abandon Kyoto because he said it was likely to cost millions of U.S. jobs.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come.
And I'm very excited to be headed out to Kansas City today, speaking on free speech and independent media in a time of war tonight, February 15th at 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Church on Warwick in Kansas City, Missouri. Looking forward to meeting a lot of KKFI listeners. It'll be wonderful to come out to another community radio station. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Juan Gonzalez. It's great to have you back as well, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners out there now that we have the situation with these new campaign finance bills that House passed this week. I'm sure that the corporate lawyers are hard at work trying to figure out new ways to get around the law to continue buying the Washington establishment.
Well, now maybe they have enough in reserve to keep them, since they've been raising it like crazy over the last weeks leading up to the passage of this bill.
Right.
So have you been spending your time watching the Olympics?
Not a whole lot. I'm still working very hard on the environmental investigations that I've been doing around Zero, but I have from time to time taken a peek at the Olympics. But, you know, so many people now are turned off to watching them because they're basically such an enormous show, an advertising show, and that you rarely get to actually see the competition as much as the storylines around all the competition.
Well, Salt Lake City certainly seems far away from Ground Zero here. We're just blocks from there. And you've been doing the groundbreaking investigations of the environment and the toxins that we haven't been told about here.
Yes, and actually there was a very important report that came out of the University of California, Davis, that got almost no attention in New York City, but did around the country. That an independent team of investigators that had set up a monitoring station 1 mile north of the World Trade Center is now reporting pollution levels that they monitored in October that were worse than anything in Kuwait during the oil fires or anything they had ever monitored in Shanghai or other places of very high pollution levels in China. And they haven't released all their data yet, but it's a pretty explosive report that they put out earlier this week. And interestingly enough, when I called them up about it, they said, well, you know, we don't understand why no one in the New York press is paying attention to this, because the Los Angeles Times and the London Times and all of these other publications played the report prominently, but the New York press, except for the report I had in my column at the Daily News, has not covered it at all.
Uh-huh. Well, you know well probably why a lot of this isn't covered, considering a number of your stories have been spiked as well. Well, as we move from Ground Zero, where it's not only about toxins in the environment, but who's going to get the billions to rebuild in that area, what many might call one of the biggest corporate boondoggles, we'll move to another one, and that's in Utah.
Well, the 2002 Winter Olympics opened in Utah a week ago, covered in gale-driven snow and wrapped in a $310 million security blanket to keep the so-called terrorists at bay. turning Salt Lake City into one of the most heavily guarded places on Earth, with an army of 15,000 troops, police, Secret Service agents, Black Hawk helicopters, and F-16 jets, armed with anti-aircraft missiles. The patriotic opening ceremony featured the tattered U.S. flag unearthed from the rubble of the World Trade Center, carried into the stadium by 8 U.S. athletes and an honor guard of New York City firefighters and cops. The star-spangled banner swept over the crowd, and throughout this week, the major media has lauded the Olympics with headlines like "Olympics Unify World in Wake of September 11th." There are 10,000 journalists in Salt Lake City this year for the spectacle of the 2002 Olympic Games, and it only took a week for the medal count of the winners to be dwarfed by accusations of conspiracy, sellout, vote-fixing by figure skating judges. But while the figure skating scandal made the world's media, the thousands of protesters outside the games every day have received barely a mention, aside from the odd jab at sullen young anarchists sloping through the streets of Salt Lake City. Protests have taken place almost every day, ranging from animal rights groups demonstrating against the Olympic rodeo to anti-police brutality demonstrations to welfare rights groups. On the opening day of the Olympics, a week ago, five people were arrested during the Kensington Welfare Rights Union March for Our Lives demonstration outside the site of the opening ceremony. Protesters, including KWRU Director Sherry Hankala, demanded that the millions of taxpayer dollars spent on the Olympics go to community needs. We're joined by one of the local protest organizers with us now, who's joining us at Democracy Now.
That's right. Amy Hines is with us, co-founder of Citizen Action Network. They held a large rally in the last few days. We're also joined by Nathaniel Lincoln Mills, who is an Olympic speed skater, participated in three Olympics, 92, 94, and 1998 in Salt Lake City now as an athletic representative. Let's start off with Amy Hines. Can you talk about why you've been protesting outside the Utah Olympics 2002.
Sure. Actually, my organization, or the organization that I'm empowered to represent, is called the Citizen Activist Network. And part of the Citizen Activist Network has been our Olympics education project. Since September, we have been doing public educational forums about different aspects of the Olympics and how Utah is being impacted by the Olympics. We've had several environmental impacts, including the creation of venues, more urban sprawl, more pollution by these Olympic Games. There has been a very, as you mentioned before, a nationalistic, a chauvinistic sort of atmosphere around the Olympic Games. There has been, for the Olympics, supposed to be a tradition of the Olympic truce, which means 1 week before, 2 weeks during, and 1 week after the Olympics, there's supposed to be a cessation of armed conflict throughout the world. And the U.S. has decided that they will be exempt from that, going into the Philippines and conducting this so-called war on terrorism during the Olympics. And not only that, but touting it and being proud of it during the Olympics and justifying it during the opening ceremonies, as we saw. There has been a great corporatization of the Olympic Games, and that's one of our main focuses. There is always a connection, no matter how much the Olympics has tried to disassociate itself from politics. There was the quote-unquote Nazi Olympics during Germany. Right now we're seeing the capitalist Olympics. This Olympics has seen, there has been no larger spending in any Olympics ever before than this one right here today. And they spent $1.3 billion for Salt Lake City in government federal funding, and in Atlanta, the Summer Games, it was $609 million. So that just poured right into 500,000 of that went to just solely courting CEOs and other people trying to get them to invest in our city. And if you look at any of the other Olympic Games, Atlanta or Nagano or Barcelona or any other, there is no statistical basis to say that there is an economic upturn after the games come and go. We've been promised increased tourism, we've been promised increased investment in our city, and we're going to get a return investment for all of our tax money going into this big party for the elite, this two-week party, instead of investing it in longer-term programs. So we're quite disappointed in that. I could go on for a long time, as you could tell. So.
Well, Amy, what's been the reaction of the local media to the protests there? I understand some of them have actually compared peaceful protests outside to terrorists, the September 11th terrorists?
Actually, it's quite amazing. For the March for Our Lives that you referred to before on February 8th, there was a complete local media shutout. We were not given any press at all here, and that included about 400 people, so we felt that we were pretty difficult to ignore, but... especially for Salt Lake City, who is a little sequestered as far as protests are concerned. But, there is right now in the legislative session has been suspended during the Olympics, but there is a corporate terrorism bill out there that basically says that if you're harassing any corporation or any business, then you do something illegal, like step off the sidewalk, for example, then your sentence will be enhanced for harassing that corporation.
We're also joined by Nathaniel Lincoln Mills. You've been in the Olympics before, not in this one. So why are you in Utah right now?
Well, I was elected by my peers to be an athlete representative with the United States Olympic Committee. I was a little reluctant at first to come out, but I did, and I'm here, and I'm amidst all the patriotism, the nationalism, the commercialism, but also around the athletes themselves and their excellence, which, you know, if you just insulate yourself and concentrate on that, it's a wonderful event. And sometimes it's hard to block everything out.
Well, let me ask you, you competed in the 1992, 94, and 98 games. What do you see as any particular trends that you in that period of time in the changes of the Olympics?
Well, even going back earlier than that, I'd say the last time the Olympic Winter Games were in the United States in 1980, there was almost no security presence. The media rights fees were minimal, and it was about the athletes. And really since then, since Juan Antonio Samaranch took the helm of the IOC, it's been a steady march toward you know, increasing commercialism. Amy already mentioned some of the budgetary numbers and the security numbers, which is probably more like $400 million. As I sit here in the Athletes' Village and look outside, I mean, there's army soldiers with rifles strung around their necks, and they are patrolling the village 24/7. That's a pretty big change.
Do you see a difference overall in terms of dissent, and actually when you go out and see people trying to make statements here in Utah, based compared to the Olympics you participated in?
I don't know. I mean, when I was participating, competing myself, like most athletes, it was a very self-absorbed endeavor. And quite frankly, I was just really concentrating on my event. And since I've retired and kind of taken a more critical look at the Olympic movement is when I become aware of some of the practices of the governing bodies, the IOC, the USOC, NBC. I don't know, I wasn't that much aware of the protesting then. I'm very aware of it now, and also very aware of the degree to which it's stifled, not just by the Salt Lake Organizing Committee, but by the IOC. And I was an athlete who spoke out on some of these issues that Amy referred to, and particularly the animal rights movement to try and stop the Olympic rodeo. And I wasn't heard, wasn't contacted by anyone. And maybe that's you know, my own or our own shortcoming as far as strategizing for publicity. But,
what is your concern about the rodeo?
Oh, just that one of the ideals in the Olympic Charter is that sport can be practiced without discrimination of any kind. And when you're abusing animals to the extent that you are in the rodeo, it just doesn't seem to be very much in the spirit of fair play. Whether that's, jolting the animals into bucking or tying cinch straps around their groins, it was offensive to the Olympic ideals to me. And, you know, again, it's one thing to display local culture out here and have a rodeo. It's another to tie it in formally with the Olympic movement. I think it was part of the Olympic Cultural Arts Festival.
Well, one of the things that surprised me in terms of the tension the last few days in terms of a particular judging contest, that there's all these questions now about the integrity of the Olympics being questioned or being a challenge now. But the reality is that given the bribery scandal that developed on the road to Salt Lake City, it's amazing that anyone in the media would talk about the integrity of the Olympics, because clearly the as you say, the role of Samarok in terms of how the Olympics has become increasingly commercialized, that is the greatest challenge to the integrity of the Olympics, and yet that seems almost forgotten, as if it's ancient history.
No doubt about it. You look at the Olympic Charter, and the IOC's charged itself with prohibiting the uncontrolled commercialism of the Olympic Games. That's language right out of the mission of the Olympic Charter. And it's also a contest among individuals, not among nations. And, you know, you look at the lofty ideals in the Charter, and you look at the practices of the IOC, and there's a wide disparity, you know, not unlike the founding documents of the United States and present practices.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Nathaniel Lincoln Mills, for joining us, three-time Olympic speed skater, now a peace teacher in the D.C. public schools, competed in 92, 94, and 98, and is in Olympics, is in Salt Lake City this year as an athletic representative. Amy Hines, co-founder of Citizen Activist Network, has been protesting outside in Salt Lake City. We come back, we're going to look at the effect of these Olympic mega events on communities. Then we're going to look at the history of protest and finally go back to an interview Juan and I did in the last Olympics with John Carlos and Tommy Smith. They were the two medalists in 1968 in Mexico City who put up their fists in the Black Power salute when they were given their awards. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Carry in the very teeth of ministry, crossbench and opposition, some rather urgent measures, quite beneath the ken of patriot and politician. Fold your flapping wings, soaring legislator. Stoop to little things, stoop to human nature. Never need to roam, members patriotic. Let's begin at home. Crime is no exotic. Bitter is your pain.
Fold your flapping wings from the Gilbert and Sullivan opera Iolanthe. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Breaking the Sound Barrier. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue a look at the Olympics. We're going to turn now to look at the effects of these games on local communities. Today's Olympic Games have become increasingly corporate, primarily about money for the local economy of the host city as well as for the host country. This year, the city of Salt Lake, not known for its raging tourist industry, wants to know how much more money will be reaped by Utah's recreation and tourism industries with the publicity generated by hosting the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. How much of the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on the Olympics will show up as profit for Utah businesses? Well, not much attention has been paid to the money taxpayers are spending to host the Winter Olympic Games. Corporations and politicians who serve them promote the Olympics in a sea of ads and TV shows, while the public is saddled with the cost of the infrastructure and services that make the Games possible. In this segment, we're going to talk about the economics of the Olympics and other mega events. Then we'll look at the history of protests during the Olympics. Matthew Burbank joins us. He is a professor of political science at University of Utah and co-author of Olympic Dreams, The Impact of Mega Events on Local Politics. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
So how much money are local businesses making?
Well, at the moment, that's very hard to tell. I think that the hotels are doing quite well. The restaurants locally are doing well, depending upon their location, but many are not doing as well as they expected. It's very much a gamble to get involved in these kinds of mega events.
Well,
Well, Matthew Burbank, we're often told about these multiplier effects of these spectacle events, that the so much money, or every visitor creates this many jobs or this much money into the local economy. What's been your experience in terms of the predictions of these economic development, the gurus of media events?
Well, of course, I mean, it's very hard to tell. The use of economic multipliers, which is a very common technique in trying to estimate the effect of any type of event, whether it's a Super Bowl or an Olympics or just building a new building and bringing in jobs, despite all the science of economics, is still fairly imprecise. We don't know what the size of the multiplier is, and in order to have an impact, we need to estimate that, and so what we're doing is we're really making a guess as to what we think it is. But the nature of estimating the economic effects, some aspects of it are quite simple. For example, I think the models that are commonly used are very good at predicting, for example, the number of visitors you're likely to get, how much those visitors will spend and where they'll spend it and what they'll spend it on, what they'll spend their money on. Those kinds of predictions are much more difficult. So in the aggregate, I think we get a pretty good sense, and certainly there is an economic benefit in the short term to hosting something like the Olympics, even when you consider the displacement effect. That is, when you bring in Olympic visitors, you're often displacing convention visitors and business visitors and other sorts of people. On the other hand, the real question, of course, is not can you generate short-term increase in tax revenue or business revenue, but is there going to be a sustained and lasting effect? That is, are you going to generate more tourists over the next 3 to 5 years? And that really is a much more difficult thing to pin down. It depends so much on things like the overall economy. If the economy is doing well, then you may indeed get people who come visit the city. If the economy is not doing well as it's right now, you may never see those benefits materialize.
Well, Matthew Burbank, I want to thank you for being with us. Olympic Dreams, the impact of mega events on local politics. Before we go to the history of protest, we wanted to go for a minute to Susie Snyder, who is with the Shundahai Network. Yesterday, the U.S. and Britain declared their love for nuclear weapons with a joint Valentine's Day subcritical nuclear test in Nevada. The test, codenamed Veto, was held at the Nevada test site and carried out in direct violation of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. In protest of yesterday's underground event, a group of peace and nuclear abolition activists gathered in Salt Lake City to raise awareness and demand an end to nuclear testing. Here's what Susie Snyder had to say.
My name is Susie Snyder. I'm with the Shundahai Network here in Salt Lake City, where the Olympics are going on today. And today, the United States and Great Britain did a joint subcritical nuclear weapons test in Nevada. So we held a very vocal demonstration in front of the Nevada Tourism Bureau earlier this afternoon, where we were, demanding to know why the United States and Great Britain are continuing to do nuclear weapons experiments at a time where we're calling for global peace and an end to terrorism, and yet we continue to hold the world hostage to our nuclear terror. We had a great demonstration. Like I said, it was very vocal. We were going for about 45 minutes until the cops came and tried to shut us down. They were unsuccessful in shutting us down, and although we had to put our bullhorn away, they were still very loud, and we had a great response by the crowd. There were hundreds of people milling around on the streets, and we had a great response from those folks.
Why did you have the protest in Utah?
Well, the Olympics are happening here, and there's a lot of downwinders here in Utah, and these tests have historically affected Utah as much as they've affected Nevada. And the Olympics are going on, and it's a global issue, and we support Olympic truce, and this is a step in the wrong direction for Olympic truce.
And that was Susie Snyder, program director of the Shundahai Network. As we turn now to a speech recently given by Larry Gerlach, who is professor of sport history at the University of Utah. It's a speech on the history of protest during the Olympics, given at the Citizen Activist Network Forum in Salt Lake City just a couple of weeks ago. This is Professor Larry Gerlach.
Olympic Games have always been what their founders wanted them to be, that is, political. And politics, of course, beget protests. The Salt Lake Winter Games is a case in point. Since September 11, the most persistent topic of public commentary from the Salt Lake Organizing Committee has been the security measures taken to protect the games against both the potential of international terrorist acts and the reality of protest demonstrations by various domestic groups. Security measures falling somewhere between prudent precaution and paranoia have been taken, and yet the concern is so great that editorials and columns in the local newspapers continue to criticize protest activities as unwelcome intrusions. This from champions, supposedly, of free speech. The Salt Lake City Council has even passed an ordinance banning the wearing of masks while engaged in disruptive behavior. Salt Lake City previously enacted such an ordinance. It was 1925. The target was the Ku Klux Klan. The real effect of that ordinance was to run off the streets trick-or-treaters at Halloween and Santa Claus at Christmas. Tonight, I want to talk about three kinds of Olympic protests. The first is protests within the Olympic movement. The second is protests within the Olympic Games themselves. And third, protests outside the Olympic Games. I'll give you a couple of examples of each. The Olympic movement itself has consistently engaged in several kinds of protest activities. Banishment is clearly a means of protesting behavior. And so after World War I, the International Olympic Committee registered disapproval of military aggression by not inviting Germany to the 1920 and 24 Games. And after World War II, the IOC similarly banned Germany and Japan from the 1948 Games. In 1923, the IOC banned the Soviet Union because of the politics of the Bolshevik Revolution. The Soviet Union and its Eastern European allies did not participate in the Olympics until 1952. Expulsion is another form of protest. The IOC expelled South Africa from the Olympics for 32 years, 1960, 1992, because of its policy of apartheid. For the same reason, Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, was expelled from 1972 to 1980. And most recently, the IOC kicked out Afghanistan because of its position on women and women's sports. Boycotts are a time-honored diplomatic instrument of behavior modification. Threats of boycotts were part of virtually every Summer Olympics since the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. The Olympic movement faced the reality of widespread boycott, however, for the first time in 1956, just weeks before the opening ceremony of the Melbourne Games. The world was rocked by the outbreak of war between Israel and Egypt and the Soviet Union's invasion of Hungary. In response, 11 nations withdrew from the Games, and many others attended only at the last minute. Taiwan, because of the China issue, and 29 African nations, because of apartheid, boycotted the 1976 Games in Montreal. The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in December 1979 prompted the U.S.-led boycott of the 1980 Moscow Games. In tit-for-tat move, the Soviet Union, labeled the evil empire by President Ronald Reagan, led a boycott of the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles. Both of those boycotts were a bust. Protest within the Games. Protests during the Olympic Games have a long, long history. The first major intra-Games protests occurred in the 1908 London Olympics, as the opening ceremony itself witnessed two political demonstrations. First, there were two aberrations among the flags of the participating nations that flew around the stadium. The flag of Finland was missing because the Finns, then under Russian domination, decided to go without a banner rather than fly the Russian flag as instructed. And at the suggestion of Irish-American athletes on the U.S. team, the American flag alone flew at half-mast in protest of Great Britain's refusal to grant Irish independence. The second protest came as the athletes entered the stadium. They did so in 1908 for the first time in national units instead of as individuals. The Finns marched without a flag, again to protest Soviet control. And then the American flag bearer, Ralph Rose, the eventual gold medalist shot putter, to protest Britain's failure to grant home rule to Ireland, deliberately violated customary diplomatic courtesy by refusing to dip Old Glory when passing before King Edward on the reviewing stand, thereby slighting crown and country. The best known protest within the games occurred in Mexico City in 1968. During the 1960s, racial tensions reached unprecedented heights in the United States, finding expression in demonstrations, protest marches, sit-ins, murders, and mob violence. Concerned by the exploitation of black athletes in intercollegiate athletics, Harry Edwards, an African-American sociology professor at San Jose State University, proposed the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Basically, he called for a boycott of the Mexico City Olympics by black American athletes. Only one prominent black athlete supported the boycott and refused to go to the Olympics. His name was Louis Alcindor, later known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. On the fifth day of the games, two students at San Jose State, Tommy Smith, who won the 200-meter sprint in world record time, and John Carlos, who finished third in that event, stood on the victory podium. After receiving their medals, and while the U.S. national anthem was being played, they stood shoeless in black socks, eyes closed, heads bowed, single arm raised in a black-gloved fist. As Smith later explained, the black socks symbolized the poverty of black America. The gloves symbolized the power that exists in black America. Smith wore a glove on his right hand. Carlos wore a glove on his left hand. The reason being, Carlos forgot his gloves and so took one of Smith's. This was the perfect protest. Normally, television cameras would have turned away from a political protest. But demonstrating during the national anthem guaranteed Smith and Carlos center stage and worldwide attention until the music ended some 36 seconds later. Immediately castigated by the press, they were given 24 hours by the U.S. Olympic Committee to leave Mexico City, and they were banned for life from Olympic participation. Smith and Carlos were not the first or the last Olympic athletes to make protest gestures on the victory platform. Another poignant incident happened the very next day when Czech gymnast Vera Kozlovska found herself standing side by side on the victory podium with Larisa Petrik of the Soviet Union. They had tied for the gold medal in floor exercise. During the playing of the Soviet anthem, Kozlovska, outraged by the Russian military takeover of Czechoslovakia just 2 months before, conspicuously bowed her head and turned away in a clear act of political protest. Olympic officials and the press made no comment of it. Why were Smith and Carlos treated differently than Kozlovska? Was it because of race and U.S. domestic politics? Yes. Was it because their protest was so blatantly obvious that it couldn't be ignored? Yes. Perhaps there was a third factor. Kozlovska's protest was in the tradition of political acts on the podium in that it involved an established government, whereas Smith and Carlos were protesting not in support of a recognized nation state, but an unrecognized political entity, African Americans.
And you've been listening to history of the protest. Larry Gerlach, a professor at the University of Illinois, University of Utah, giving that speech. When we come back, we'll hear from the men themselves who put their fists up in the Black Power salute, John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Stay with us.
The louder it is, the better it is, the bigger it is, the better it is. Bigger is always better. Bigger is always better. Bigger is always better.
Bigger is always better. Denny Binet here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now with Juan Gonzalez to Olympics past, just where Larry Gerlach left off during the 2000 Olympic Summer Games in Sydney, when Aboriginal Australian Olympic sprinter Kathy Freeman lit the cauldron that signified the beginning of the Games. Democracy Now! Interviewed two of the most remembered Olympians of all time, bronze medalist John Carlos and gold medalist Tommy Smith, who helped create one of the most defining moments of the Olympic Games, this in 1968 in Mexico.
Yes, and as we just heard, the 68 Olympics were among the most controversial ever held. They were buffeted by the Vietnam War, the Democratic Convention in Chicago, and the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. The U.S. civil rights movement was grappling with the aftermath of the assassination of Martin Luther King, and 10 days before the Olympics were scheduled to open in October, Mexico City University students, scores of them, were killed by army troops. But officials at the Olympic Games managed to quell any disruption until two black Americans, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who finished first and third in the 200-meter run, bowed their heads and at great personal risk to themselves raised their fists in the Black Power salute during the national anthem as a protest against racism in the United States.
They were immediately thrown off the team by the U.S. Organizing Committee. 30 years have passed since that bold demonstration. We go now to a Democracy Now! Interview that Juan and I did with the two medalists during the Sydney Olympics. We started with John Carlos, and I asked him to describe the scene at the 1968 Olympic ceremony in Mexico City.
We had a stadium roughly 85,000 people in it. I think they were very pretentious in terms of what might happen based on previous conversations about possible Olympic boycotts or demonstrations. The Olympic Committee, the International Olympic Committee, as well as the United States Olympic Committee, tried to quell any type of demonstration or any type of conversation of demonstrations. And they did a pretty fair job because they pretty much intimidated a lot of athletes. They pretty much tried to bribe athletes in terms of saying, we can get you a job with this corporation, or we can make you a movie star, or we can make you a football player. In other words, if you be a good boy, we're going to put you on easy street. A lot of people felt that. A lot of people felt that the medal was far more important than any type of demonstration.
Our guests are John Carlos and Tommy Smith. They are well known for the picture that went around the world, Mexico City, 1968, as they were being given the first and third honors, medals for the 200-meter run as they bowed their heads and raised their fists in the Black Power salute during the national anthem as a protest against racism in the U.S. John Carlos, you were just setting the scene for us.
Right, and as I said, at that particular time, with all the hype of the Olympics, Tommy Smith and John Carlos got together as two young men and felt that it was the right time in society for someone to instill some sort of shock therapy to society and let them know that the social qualms that we have here in the United States as well as around the world, people needed to focus and pay a little more attention to the issues. So we decided that it was necessary that we would carry on and do something anyway other than just run and represent America on the track and raise the flag. We wanted to be a little like Kathy Freeman in terms of saying we're concerned about the little people in the world. And we got together, and as you see, we've gone to the victory stand. We hid our gloves and our pants, and when we got out to the stands and they began to play the national anthem after we received our medals, then we brought the gloves out of our pants and actually thrust them towards the sky. John Carlos in particular, I put my fist to the sky in defiance of what was happening to poor people in the United States and around the world. And I did it rather defiantly based on the fact that, you know, I felt that this is something that God wanted us to do. I feel that it was a divine effort on Tommy and John's part.
And what was the reaction first of your fellow Olympic team members and then later on of the general public in the months after that to your protest?
Tommy, you dropped that one.
The actions of Tommy Smith and John Carlos then were a surprise to everyone. Most people thought that athletes at that particular time, especially black athletes, could not think unless spoken to first with a thought of reoccurrence. We, at that particular time, had something to do, as John said, and it was given to us to do on the world's platform. It was a shock to people, and the aftermath of athletes on our team were surprised as well as the rest of the world. It was very organized movement of the black athletes of the 19th Olympiad in Mexico City. Meeting started years before. We'd had a meeting only a few days before the victory stand, and of course each athlete, as the meeting indicated of the black athletes just before, that each athlete would act according to his or her feelings toward the nation that we were living in. So it was a surprise to everybody because of its quietness and the conductivity of the athletes in those meetings. It was a decision of the athletes and not the Olympic Committee.
Well, you know, it's been now 32 years since that protest. A lot has happened in this country, and certainly in the world of sports. African Americans now and in sports like football or and basketball are dominant in the sport as and substantially in baseball. But have you seen much change in the general society in terms of some of the issues or questions that you were protesting against then?
Time will always have a change. Time will always make a change. We're talking about the mentality of people within that change, which the almighty dollar has made a change. I think the change of the pride and the effect has been more negative than positive toward the freedoms, toward the action of people who are fighting for human rights. Of course, time has changed. 32 years. You look at me and John, and you'll see that John and I have changed, too. But I do believe the minds of Tommy Smith and John Carlos has not gone off into the red in thinking that things have overwhelmingly changed because of what we did. We sacrificed, as a lot of people have sacrificed. Some rule, some don't rule.
In 1994, when Kathy Freeman did her victory lap wrapped in the Aboriginal flag, she was shunned by a lot of Australia. And for years, she didn't make another political statement. I think it surprised many this summer when just before these games, and she's considered Australia's best bet for an Olympic track medal, she made these political comments about how her people are being treated. What happened to both of you after you put your hands up in the Black Power salute? I mean, obviously, you were star athletes. You had won the first and some of the highest medals in all of at the Olympic Games.
First, I'd like to say that Kathy Freeman was shunned prior to her going to the Olympic Games or prior to her taking part in sports. She was shunned just based on her ethnicity. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, as many blacks or most blacks in the United States, were being shunned. Only time that we are recognized is if we go to war and we put our lives and our blood on the line, and then when we come back home, we're shunned. When we go into battle, into sports, we're recognized and honored as long as we behave. When we come back home, we're shunned until the next time the flag is raised or next time the war is raised. We are looking for equality as human beings. Based on what Kathy Freeman did, based on what Tommy Smith and John Collins did, we were individuals that God appointed to be icons for the poor. So relative to what the United States did, they didn't do any more than what they did to black people all over the world. Close us out from employment, close us out from fair living conditions, slandered our kids in school, had many of our friends to step away from us, to have us even at one time or another look at ourselves and see whether we were right in what we did, just based on the fact that all the commotion was about a very nonviolent activity that took place to educate society.
And that's what John says. America is a very strong country, and he has his people under his thumb most of the time, and those people won't reveal their feelings because the loss they feel that would be forthcoming if they would do that. It's called a sacrifice when you stand up for a right, when you stand up for a feeling, when you stand up for a meaning. And that's why John Collins and Tommy Smith went through and still going through what we had, because the people are afraid to stand up for those people who are really sacrificing for their benefit.
Well, John Collins, the Olympics have been under increasing scrutiny over corruption scandals in the Olympic Organizing Committee. There's increasing commercialization of amateur sports. What is your view of the impact of all of this corporate dominance of amateur sports and sports in general in America?
Well, as Tommy said, times have changed. And, you know, the flame, the Olympic flame used to be burned off of gas or coal. Now the Olympic flame is burned off of dollar bills, $1,000 bills, $1 million bills, and so forth like that. This is why, you know, there's so much drugs in the Olympics now in terms of the athletes using various drug enhancements to affect their performance, based on the fact that there is a large percentage of money involved, not only for the athlete himself, but for that country and overall for the International Olympic Committee. So this is why the drug system is going on the way it's gone. This is why world records have been falling, like people just dropping change out of their pockets. You know, Tommy is the best in the world ever. When you sit back and you look at Tommy Smith, Tommy can tell you what it takes to break a world record. If as great as Tommy Smith was, or Bob Hayes, or Wilma Rudolph, they know what it takes to break world records, and they know it wasn't a thing that you can go out and break a world record every time you hit the track. And this is what's happening with these young individuals. I'm not naive about it, and I don't think that the Olympic Committee nor the U.S. Olympic Committee is naive about it as well. So therefore, you have to say that times have changed. You know, individuals say now, well, you know, steroids is the thing of the day, and we should accept it if it's going to help the kid enhance his performance, then I don't see anything wrong with it. Well, I'll tell you right away that the steroids of today are killing young athletes. They don't put it in the news. They don't expel upon that as much as they should. If you think about Lyle Alzado, the football player, when he was playing football, he took drugs and steroids and enhancements to make his performance better as he was dying. He made a special video, he and his wife, to tell kids this is taboo, stay away from it. As soon as Lyle Alzado died, they never mentioned Lyle Alzado. They never mentioned that video. They never mentioned what he said about steroids or poison. So it's almost like these individuals are being duped into taking these drugs. They're being duped into, you know, shooting for the goal, so to speak. And when I say the goal, it's not the same goal that Tommy Smith or John Collins were shooting for. They're shooting for the goal in the sky. They give individuals at championship events gold bullion. That's telling you right there. Do whatever is necessary to do to come out of the ghettos now and be our stars, because now we're feeding you as an individual. We're not feeding your race, but we will feed you.
John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Olympic winners of 1968, became a symbol of protest and militancy for another generation. Did you go on in sports? What specifically did each of you have you done in these 32 years? Were you able?
After the games, during those times, John Carlos, Tommy Smith were into the social issues of families, and we had families, and we could not run and train the way we train without substances, without human element help. We had to help ourselves in terms of finance. We had to get jobs. Plus, we were typically banned from any international and national competition by the USOC because they didn't have the information that they wanted before the victory stand, so they could tell the world what these boys were going to do, as Avery Brundage used to label us so frequently as boys. So we had the life to continue the best way we possibly could, since the system did not help.
We were ostracized. You know what? A lack of money brings contempt into anyone's household. They broke up our families. We were not able to give our kids what kids should have in terms of being prepared for school. We couldn't buy school paper for our kids. We couldn't buy books. A lot of times we didn't have clothes for our kids. I recall living in my house at one time, having to chop my furniture up and throw my furniture in the furnace and in the fireplace, and have my family sleep around the fireplace in order for us just to stay warm, because I didn't have money to pay my electric bill. I didn't have money to buy food for my kids. I had to go out and be subjected to women that liked me, you know, to stay with them, to have money to feed my wife, to feed my kids. It wasn't the right thing to do, but it was a necessary thing to do. I recall they would send letters to my wife and take pictures if I went around to various universities to give speeches. They were trying to break the divide in my household, which they accomplished. But yet and still, as I said, God is good, and we're alive and well and here today to tell the world, yes, we still stand strongly behind what we did in 1968. We feel that things have changed relatively slow in this society. But yet and still, I think more people are starting to wake up to the fact that this is an issue that they need to discuss. And we need to get by the discussion portion and move ahead and start making the changes.
You know, it reminds me of Rosa Parks. Everyone looks at her individual act as if it came out of nowhere. In fact, she was very disciplined, had been basically, in a sense, training for years to do what she did. She was an organized, nonviolent protester. I don't think a lot of people realize that what you did in 1968 was part of what was called the 1968 Revolt of the Black Athlete, and that it was actually a project, the Olympic Project for Human Rights. Of course, you had to decide whether or not you were going to do it to the last second, I mean, before the world, to stand up, knowing what you would face. But
well, I don't think that we decided the last second that we were going to do something. I think that we knew we were going to do something as strongly as various individuals felt that Olympic medal was more important than life itself.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos, the medalists in the 200-meter sprint in 1968, stood up at the awards ceremony, getting the bronze and the gold medal, and put up their fists in the Black Power salute. Juan and I spoke to them during the Sydney Games about their protest. And that does it for this program, Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Thanks to the Pacifica Archives and KRCL Community Radio in Salt Lake City. Again, I'm really looking forward to seeing folks in Kansas City, in Missouri tonight. I'm headed out now, and we'll be speaking tonight, 8 o'clock at All Souls Unitarian Church on Warwick in Kansas City. I'm looking forward to meeting.
There's a lot of interest in that talk. I've even gotten phone calls here in New York from people asking about that talk. So I'm sure that you're going to have a nice crowd out there.
Well, it'll be wonderful to meet KKFI listeners. Folks, you can also go to our website to get more information at www.democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. And you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. Well, from downtown community television, just blocks from Ground Zero, I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!